online, on digital radio and television, and on the ABC Listen app. The Tasmanian Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
A lot of people had a misperception about what was actually driving the depletion in sand flathead as well. Over many years, we've been taught that large industrial fishing, commercial fishing is what depletes fish stocks. But that's actually not the case for sand flathead. It has been the recreational fishery that has driven the depletion.
Scientists talking to Tasmania's wreck fishers, part of their job will be to talk to people about why taking too much sand flathead has left the fishery depleted. And we take a look at the role of women at home during World War II, particularly women that kept Australians fed.
They were desperately in need of workers. So in 1942, the Land Army was created and 6,000 women signed up.
We'll have that story and a whole lot more in the program today. We'll talk to some dedicated light horsemen also who are travelling Australia to attend ceremonies. And later in the program, would you like camel milk in your latte? Why not try something a little different? Would you give it a go? 0438 922 936. What are you up to on Anzac Day? Have you been having a think about those that have served for us over the decades? Or are you just taking a little bit of time off? Well, sit back, have a listen, enjoy the Country Hour today. And we're going to start with fishing. The results of a survey from 1,500 of Tasmania's recreational flathead fishers are in. And they confirmed that a majority of people agree that the state's sand flathead stock is in poor condition. The Institute of Marine and Antarctic Sciences is working with the Department of Natural Resources and Environment to try to turn things around, and they say education is key. Lead fisheries scientist at IMAS, Professor Sean Tracy, talked us through what the survey found and what happens next.
About 63% of respondents agreed that the sand flathead stock was in a poor or very poor condition. There were regional differences in that. Particularly in the southeast, people were saying that the stock was in a very poor condition. We also saw that a lot of people had a misperception about what was actually driving the depletion in sand flathead as well. And it's quite normal. I guess over many years, we've been taught that large industrial fishing, commercial fishing is what depletes fish stocks. But that's actually not the case for sand flathead. It has been the recreational fishery that has driven the depletion. And that's just due to the sheer number of Tasmanians and people that actually enjoy going out and catching the fish.
Where do you think that particular misconception has come from, and how do you then tackle it?
So that's one of the biggest challenges in front of us, is how we fix that misperception. So there are a couple of issues leading to that. One, as I said, is that people just innately believe that large-scale commercial fishing is what depletes stocks. We see that in other parts of the world, imagery of large trawlers taking lots of fish out. At a more local scale, what we see is that there is a commercial fishery that operates into Tasmania for flathead, but it's actually a different species that's unloaded into Tasmania. It's called tiger flathead. It looks similar, but it's actually caught further offshore, and it's not the species that's currently of concern.
Given most respondents did say they agree that there are issues with depletion of sand flathead, whether that is size or whether it's how many fish they're actually catching, how do you then work with them to try and implement change?
So obviously for people to be part of the solution, they need to also acknowledge that they're part of the problem. So there is a very big communication piece here about helping fishers in the community understand what has driven this depletion. The department has reacted by changing recreational fishing catch restrictions. So there's bag limits and size limit changes. They have also fully shut down commercial fishing for a period of time for sand flathead as well. So the department has already started a program called Flathead for the Future. So they're doing a lot of education work through that based on some of the scientific research that we've done. We're also working very closely with Tarfish, who's the peak body for recreational fishing in Tasmania, and we'll be working on them with a stewardship program. So again, a big part of that is working with the recreational fishery to understand their role in this particular fishery and the things that they can do to support the regrowth of the population. Another really important piece that we're looking at as well is alternate species. We're very lucky in Tasmania that there are actually a range of fish species that we can catch. We also have some species that are becoming more common through ocean warming. So things like yellowtail kingfish and pink snapper and King George whiting, all very, very popular recreational species on the mainland where they're fairly abundant. They're moving into Tasmanian waters more frequently. So there are a lot of opportunities to think of other fish or try and catch other fish and enjoy the challenge of maybe cooking fish that you may not have tried before or trying different fishing methods to catch different fish as well. So it doesn't mean we have to stop fishing. It's just thinking more broadly about what we do across the fishery.
In terms of alternate fishes that people were saying they were also interested in or just their responses broadly, it seems like there was variation depending on the demographic of the person actually responding to the survey. What kind of differences were you seeing dependent on age or how frequently they may fish?
Younger fishers were actually more accepting of the need for change and taking, you know, responsibility through bag limit cuts and size limit changes. The other thing we saw is that harvest-based fishers, so those that were fishing predominantly to take fish home to eat, were also a little bit more reluctant to the change than those that were going out for the experience of hanging out with mates and enjoying recreational fishing as an activity. So there were some really interesting demographic responses, and this is something that, you know, is one of the biggest challenges in managing a recreational fishery, is there are many different users and have very different aspects about how they like to use the fishery or how that what they value out of a fishery.
If the education campaigns are successful, if you're able to shift some of those attitudes, how quickly would we be able to see those flathead stocks increase or improve?
That's the million-dollar question, and we're doing a lot of work on that at the moment as well. So we're doing some modelling to look at how quick we can recover the stock. We're pretty hopeful that this could be fairly quick in some areas. They're a fairly fast-growing fish. They're also highly fecund, which means they produce a lot of eggs. So if everything goes well and there's good compliance, we'd expect it to come back reasonably quickly. And we're also using a strategy in this management regime, which is a little bit different as well. We've put in a maximum size limit. So that means once a fish gets over a certain size, you also have to release it. The rationale behind that is that then it protects those larger females that produce disproportionately more eggs. So we're really protecting that top end of town that will produce much more biomass more quickly back into the stock.
And that was Sean Tracy from the Institute for Marine and Antarctic Studies. And staying with fish, the Fisheries Research and Development Corporation is taking a big step to build the skills of the next generation of stock assessment scientists with a project aimed at getting more people on board. The FRDC has said with only about 100 stock assessment scientists currently available, with some heading towards retirement, it's a priority that they train up more. The corporation says stock assessments are critical for determining the relative status of fish populations. Kathy Dishmont is a consultant who's been helping with a project that has included an online game that shows what the role could include.
Yeah, it's exactly at hard science with counting the stock. So we're basically using mathematics and statistics to work out through scientific methods the population size and the condition of the resource and whether the resource is being managed sustainably. And if it's not, then what we need to do to be sustainable from a perspective of catch, for example.
And do you have to have any particular background to do this role?
Yeah, most people would be coming from the mathematics and statistics field. The other place people would be coming from is biology. It's actually a method that uses both mathematics stats on one hand and biology on the other hand. So if you start on the one side, which is, say, for example, biology, then you have to learn the math and stats to do it. And if you start in the stats side, then you have to learn the biology to do it. So you generally find it's a team group of people that work together to do this work rather than just one person.
And so this new project that you have been a part of to get more people involved in these roles, tell us about that.
Yeah, so the project is a capacity building project. So we're trying to work with the existing stock assessment people, but also there's a lot of new recruits that have come into the area from various places. And we've been trying to change the way we work rather than just a set of individuals working on their own, creating a community feel and then also building on their knowledge. And we sort of, the project's doing four things. Sort of one thing is trying to learn who the thought leaders are in the field and how they connect to each other, and how people outside can access those thought leaders, changing the way we do courses by doing it as a community. So in other words, rather than one being done within an organisation, inviting people outside an organisation so that people can meet each other and learn in a community. A third part is to create tools and resources that are on the web, which is that web link I gave you, which tells you about what is available out in the big world in terms of really free stuff. And then the final one is the game that we did, which is learning from play. So allowing people to just, instead of doing something in real life, they get given a simulated resource and then try and see how well they do on that.
Tell us more about this game and what they had to actually do.
Yeah, so we basically, two of us in the project were the only ones that knew the answer. So we basically simulated a resource. It looked a little bit like an East Coast species, but people didn't know that, and because we put it into Planet Pandora. And we basically then simulated the data set that people could get if they were trying to do an assessment. It was actually quite a difficult case study, so we didn't give them a simple case. So the species was tended to move from north to south and from the inshore to offshore. Quite a lot of fish in the East Coast do that. They get born, say, in seagrass and mangrove habitat and then move offshore as they get older. And so we simulated that, but they didn't know that. They just got the data, and they knew a little bit about the biology of a species. And we asked them to try and assess the resource. And because it was difficult, we were hoping that people would form teams, and that is exactly what happened. So people formed teams and worked together in groups of various sizes to do this assessment. And we asked people to then say, how did they go about it, what decisions they made, and also to ask them what was the stock status. And there was a prize in it for whoever came the closest.
Who was the overall winner?
Northern Territory Fisheries. They came the closest.
And so this game, was that essentially showing what they would be doing in real life in a stock assessment role?
Yes, it was trying to emulate what they would do in real life. The difference is, and I think that's why people were really attracted to it, was that in real life, you're managing a fishery and you're affecting people's income. So it has very serious consequences, and it's quite stressful to take risks, for example. So, you know, it's a bit like when you're driving a car and it's raining and there's lots of other cars, you're going to be a much more careful driver than when someone says, take your car and go on this empty road and there's no speed limit because it's a racing track, you know. So you're much more willing to play around with a car and see what it can do. And so that was exactly what we wanted them to do, was to take risks and to see what happens if I try it this way or the other way. So and that's exactly what they did.
Consultant Kathy Ditchmont speaking with Brooke Neindorf.
G'day, it's Leon Compton. Have you got a question for the candidates in the Legislative Council race for PROSA?
We need to stop logging old growth forests. This is madness.
I'll be talking to them on Tuesday.
Where are we ending up? Rental increases, young people aren't able to afford.
The Mornings team will be in Sorell.
I love it because, I mean, there's never any traffic. The housing is quite affordable.
Come along, share your stories. That's Tuesday morning from 8:30.
That's really what I'd like to see.
On ABC Radio Hobart.
It's the Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Midway through World War II, it was clear that the war would not end quickly, and Australia desperately needed to keep its farms and primary industries operating. The Australian Women's Land Army was born. Thousands of women around the country answered the call. Author and researcher Victoria Perman based one of her novels around the work women did helping to feed Australia during World War II.
I didn't know Australia had a women's land army during World War II. I knew vaguely that the UK had set up land armies in World War I and II, but it wasn't until I was researching a previous book that I came across, I love looking at old newspapers, and I came across an article about a women's land army. And I thought, if I don't know about the Australian women who gave up their city lives and went to the country, then surely I can't be alone. So that set me off down the rabbit hole of discovering the really important role that these women played in World War II in actually keeping our troops and the country fed.
Well, we often hear about the land armies in the UK, et cetera, but we did the same kind of thing here, what, sort of midway through the Second World War?
Yeah, the land army began in 1942. I think when the war, people started to realise the war was going to go on, and you know, hundreds of thousands of men had enlisted to serve, 990,000 Australians, in fact. So there was a big shortage in the agricultural industries. So it wasn't just about feeding Australians. It was about supplying all those foodstuffs for the troops as well. And, you know, hundreds of thousands of people needed feeding. So the federal government, reluctantly at first, and some of the agricultural organisations, I must say, were reluctant at first to establish such a thing, but they had no choice, actually. They were desperately in need of workers. So in 1942, the land army was created and 6,000 women signed up.
They advertised? Do you know if there was some sort of campaign?
They did advertise, yes. Yeah. They advertised, and there were beautiful ads in the women's magazines. I used the Women's Weekly ads at the time, which portrayed the life of a land girl as energetic and healthy and outdoors. And they were, I mean, they were the best kind of propaganda, in a sense, that they were women doing country things in the fresh air, and it all looked fantastic. And for some of them, it was that life, but it was hard work, as anyone who farms or, you know, has property in the regions would know.
What sort of women applied to become part of the land army?
They were women from the cities, office workers, those who were doing clerical work, shop assistants, who wanted that big adventure. And some were motivated by that sense of adventure. Others were motivated because they had family who had enlisted. Many in their families had enlisted, and they too wanted to do their bit. I did read about one land girl who was so angry that her brother had been given a white feather. Which, you know, was a sign of cowardice. And men, for a whole range of reasons, couldn't enlist. Perhaps they were in essential services back here in Australia, or perhaps they had a disability that might not have been obvious to others. But yeah, there was white feathers being handed out. And she was so furious at this, she decided to enlist in the land army. So they had all kinds of reasons, really. But I think, you know, 66,000 women in Australia, wow, signed up for in branches of the women's services. Yeah, and some were nurses, right, on the front lines in hospital ships. But there were other women who gave up their comfortable lives and put on overalls and
moved out to the country.
Moved out to the country. All over Australia, from, you know, picking cotton in Queensland to working in apple orchards in Tassie, picking cherries in South Australia and oranges in Gosford. They worked everywhere there was a need for agricultural labour.
And that's the sort of things they did. They harvested. Do you know, have you heard any other stories?
They did. They harvested all kinds of crops. They drove tractors to plough fields. Some actually worked as technical assistants in the forerunner of the CSIRO. They did everything that was necessary. And when a story that I particularly loved was when flax supplies dried up from Europe because of obviously the war, the English government worked with the Australian government to plant flax. Flax, as we know, makes linen, and that linen thread was used for parachutes and shoelaces and all kinds of things. So Australia created a flax industry, and wow, women were needed to work there, and it was hard work.
And so they kept they started that one, but they kept a lot of primary industries going through the war. So quite vital, some of that work.
They certainly did. And I've set my book, The Land Girls, partly in Mildura, because Mildura had per head the highest enlistment rate in the country. And I thought that was a really interesting place to set the book because it was the hub of the dried fruits industry. So the dried fruits were not only important for people at home, but they were in ration packs. Dried sultanas were in ration packs for the boys who are away. And anyone who made a fruit cake to send to a loved one had dried fruit in it. So I had my characters go up to Mildura to work in that industry. But they were, women were doing everything.
That's spuds, fantastic. Yeah.
Apples, pears, beans, grapes, cotton, oh, everything.
And they did this during the war. Do you have any sense of how they went after the war, whether some women, you know, went back to the home or they stayed in primary industries?
The Land Army was officially disbanded at the very end of 1945, 31st of December, and they all lost their jobs. Some of them went back to their lives, but I sensed a real a sense of adventure that had been that had flourished in them. And I listened to oral histories of women who served in the Land Army. It gave them an independence they hadn't had before. They're away from home, away from the strictures of life at that time. They were living with other young women. And I mean, although it was hard work, I'm sure that would have been tremendous fun, a bit like going on camp. A couple of women bought a farm and decided to stay in the country. Another couple of women I read decided to take a trip around New Zealand in a car they'd bought in New Zealand. And I thought, when I was researching the book, I thought these must have been really unusual pursuits for women of that era, when our assumption is that they all went back home and the boys came home and women went back to the kitchens and so on. And some women said, I like this working thing, I'm not giving it up. So they went into other, back to their professions or picked up, you know, permanent work. I met one Land Army girl who was a real treat, and I asked her, after the war, did you quit work altogether and raise your kids? And she said, no, we couldn't afford to. It took two incomes to afford a mortgage.
And that was Victoria Perman. She's a novelist and researcher into the Women's Land Army in Australia. Now, have you heard about Australia's Light Horse Brigade? The Mounted Infantry was originally formed in 1888 in Wagga Wagga, New South Wales. Mick Batchelor is a member of the Riverina Light Horse Troop and travels around Australia to keep the memory alive by attending ceremonies dressed in World War One uniform and riding his horses to reenact the light horse tradition. Lily McCure spoke to Mick as he passed through Broken Hill yesterday on his way to yet another Anzac Day ceremony.
We've got five horses, four riders. So in the light horse, four riders is a pretty important number because that's what they call a section. And the light horse used to operate in a section. That was a fighting unit and a good way to manage your horses together. Group of four.
How did you get involved with this and training the light horse?
Always had an interest in the history because my father being a World War II veteran and he was in the light horse prior to the start of World War II before they disbanded it, and he always spoke fondly of it. And then I sort of got involved with him in his later life, helping him in March, like Anzac Day in a march, sort of like a carer. And then I thought, well, I could do better than this. When my dad passed away, I thought I'd still march for him, but I'd like to do it on a horse and represent the light horse tradition. So I got in contact with the Australian Light Horse Association. At the time, the president was Phil Chalker, and then they steered me in the right direction to get the right equipment. And then we formed our own troop, which we call the Riverina Light Horse Troop, which is based at Wagga. But it's made up of members from around the Riverina. We travel and do our local shows and things, but we also go further afield. Last year, our troop went up to Darwin Royal Show and Catherine, Alice Springs. And this year, we're not all going, but I'm heading back up there to do the Northern Territory show run. And I think I've got a bit of work to do around some of the schools and communities up there with the light horse.
What was the role of a light horseman within the war?
Well, everyone thinks that the light horseman's like a cavalry. The light horse was mounted infantry. The reason they were on horses was to save them foot slogging, and which meant they could get from A to B a lot quicker than an infantry man on foot. So the horses were actually only for transport. They weren't there for fighting off the back of. On the rare occasion they did do a charge, was at Besheba, that everyone knows the charge of Besheba, and that's where the Turks made a mistake, thinking that they'll come in so far and then dismount for action, but they didn't dismount, and they kept going. And that actually wasn't the last charge that the Australian Light Horse did. A little bit later than that, they did another charge at a place called Shamak to capture a railway station there. And that was officially the last charge that they did. But like I say, usually it was just a former transport horse and the fighting was still on the ground, but the horse would get you there quicker than foot slogging.
How important is it to remember the horses that were involved in the war and the light horsemen?
Well, in World War One, for an example, over 160,000 horses left Australia and only one came back, and that was General Bridges' horse, Sandy. General Bridges was shot by a sniper at Gallipoli, and his dying wish was that his horse, favourite horse, be returned back to Australia for his funeral, because they did take his body back home. Most people got buried overseas, but his body did come back, and that horse did come back. It's a whole story on its own, but that was the only horse out of 160,000 horses that left Australia that came back. And also, there was over 160,000 mules come out of Australia that went overseas too for service, and none of them came back.
And that was Mick Batchelor there talking to Lily McCure. Time for the news headlines now with Rachel Fisher.
Thanks, Fiona. In ABC News, in Tasmania's northwest, a 41-year-old man has been charged with stealing a gas meter from a Devonport laundromat. The theft caused a gas leak that shut down businesses in the area Tuesday morning. He was also charged with stealing copper. Tasmania police say the arrest was part of a broader investigation into the ongoing theft of copper and other precious metals. King Island Mayor Marcus Blakey says he's concerned residents may, in some cases, be being ripped off by expensive flights. A resident recently raised concerns on social media after trying to book a one-way fare for later this month, which was going to cost more than $1,000. Marcus Blakey says the island is something of a victim of its own success, with high tourism demand driving up prices. And a 37-year-old Huon Valley man has been charged with arson and unlawfully setting fire to property. Police say the man was charged in relation to a number of allegedly deliberately lit fires in Kingston earlier this month. The fires caused about $100,000 damage and resulted in the hospitalisation of a 77-year-old woman with smoke inhalation. More news at 1.
Thank you, Rachel. Time now to cross to the Weather Bureau. And good afternoon, Matthew Thomas.
Hi, Fiona.
Hello. Now, has there been much rainfall overnight?
Look, most of the rainfall to 9 a.m. was around the west of the state, typically around 5 to 15 millimetres. A few locations picked up higher than that. The usual suspects, 35 millimetres at Mount Reid and 30 millimetres at Lake Margaret. And other than outside the west, we saw about 0 to 2 millimetres about sort of parts of the northwest through the central plateau and down about parts of the Upper Derwent Valley and the southeast forecast district. And since 9 a.m, we've seen just some light showers continuing to the west of the state in amounts of around 1 to 2 millimetres.
All right. Now tell me about the outlook.
So the weather today is very much driven by a high pressure system that is sitting to the south of Western Australia, and that combined with the cold front across yesterday is sort of providing a cool southwesterly stream over Tasmania, and we'll see that just continue into tomorrow and just ease and tend more westerly as the high moves over the Bight. For the remainder of today, what we're looking at is to see that the showers just remain around the west and the far south of the state. We won't see terribly much, however, into the rain gauge, probably, you know, another 1 to 2 millimetres about the west of the state, and just a slight chance of showers about the far south. Should be fine elsewhere, but those southwesterly winds will begin to ease about the across the state as that high just moves over the Bight tomorrow. The wind's just tending a little bit more westerly, and we'll see the fine conditions apart from those showers pushing into the west of the state. And we're only looking at around 1 to 5 millimetres about the west of the state tomorrow. Into Saturday, that high pressure system just passing to the north of the state, and we'll see a fine day over much of Tasmania, light showers about the west and the Bass Strait Islands. As the high sort of sits to the north of the state on both Saturday and into Sunday, we'll probably see some cooler mornings about the north of the state. We'll probably see a little bit of frost possible, but with temperatures sort of getting down towards 0 degrees. But on Sunday, that high just as over Victoria, just moving out to the northeast with a northerly stream to begin to develop through the course of the morning, and some light showers beginning to develop around the middle of the day about the north and pushing into the west of the state, but then increasing about the west late in the evening as a cold front approaches. As that front approaches, we'll see the northerly winds pick up late on Sunday and become sort of fresh and gusty, particularly about the west and the south of the state, with showers extending statewide early on Monday, but more likely about the west of the state, but then quickly easing and contracting back to the west and the far south later in the morning. And so through the forecast period, most of the rainfall is going to be about the west of the state, just a slight chance of 0 to 2 millimetres elsewhere on Monday.
Any warnings at all?
So we do have a fair few warnings, actually, with the southwesterly stream we've got. So we've got a gale warnings current to eastern and southern coastal waters from Wineglass Bay to southeast Cape for southwesterly winds. A strong wind warning is current for remaining northern, eastern and southern coastal waters from Stanley to Low Rocky Point, excluding Bank Strait and Franklin Sound. Strong wind warnings also current for most of the southeast inshore waters except for the Derwent Estuary, as well as for the Central Plateau Lakes. And into tomorrow, those strong wind warnings contract back to eastern and southern coastal waters from Wineglass Bay to Low Rocky Point.
What about the coastal waters and swell, Matthew?
Certainly. So what we've got in terms of the coastal waters, we've got west to southwesterly winds 20 to 30 knots, although 25 to 35 knots about the south and the lower east, and only 15 to 25 knots about the west of the state. And the winds are easing back about all waters during the afternoon and evening, and into tomorrow morning. We'll start off with west to southwesterly winds of 10 to 20 knots about the north, grading to 15 to 25 knots about the south, but reaching up to 30 knots in the south and the lower east during the morning and early afternoon. Now, in terms of the swells, around the west and the south, southwesterly of 4 to 5 metres, although up to 5.5 metres offshore about the southeast during the afternoon. But those swells then easing, decaying back to be 3 to 4 metres by later on Friday. Through the north, we've got a westerly of 1 to 1.5 metres, decaying back to below 1 metre during Friday. And about the east, there's a southerly of 1.5 to 2.5 metres, building up to 3 to 4 metres offshore in the south. And the swell on the wave rider buoy is currently 3.8. The significant wave on the wave rider buoy is currently 3.8 metres with a maximum wave of 5.5 metres and a 13-second period.
Thank you very much, Matthew Thomas.
Have a great day.
If you love country music, you'll love ABC Country. You get a fast car. It's Australia's home of country music. The music you grew up with.
And you'll be the captain.
All the latest country hits.
I ain't proud.
And emerging artists.
Because, baby, we've been up
24 hours commercial free. ABC Country. It's on your DAB Plus digital radio and the ABC Listen app.
coast to coast, this is The Country Hour. You're with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
The Australian Veterinary Association wants the federal government to provide education fee relief to vets to address workforce shortages in rural and remote areas. The Regional Education Commissioner made the recommendation in its latest report. Australian Veterinary Association President Dr. Diana Barker explains why this is an important solution to the vet shortage crisis.
The Regional Education Commissioner's annual report, so the Honourable Fiona Nash, has called out that the veterinary workforce is in crisis and we do have a workforce shortage, especially and particularly in regional and rural Australia. What the report calls for is education fee relief, which will encourage graduate veterinarians to go into rural areas and support the local communities there. This is something the Australian Veterinary Association has been calling on for several years. And additionally, that there should be changes to the funding models of training. So currently, at the moment, we see veterinarians as a requirement of graduating from a veterinary degree, needing to do 52 weeks of unpaid placement. And this requirement really limits vets' ability to go into rural regional vets for that clinical work, mainly because being that it's unpaid, needing to pay for travel costs, needing to pay for accommodation to complete that placement, when it's much easier to sort of stay at home where you're already paying rent or you've already got your part-time job, much easier to go to clinics that are closer to home. So there is a lack of those students going into rural and regional communities. We do see that if students are able to go into those communities, that there is a bit more of an uptake in terms of them going rurally. But this education fee relief will also sort of play a big part in incentivising those graduates to going into those communities, which are crying out for vets.
And you mentioned just before that it's been a problem for some time. When did it start, do you think? Or is it sort of something that's been creeping up for a while now?
Yeah, look, we had a report about 20 years ago foreseeing this to be a problem. But really, I think the COVID-19 pandemic probably compounded it. But it's been happening. It's been happening long before that. Vets have it's hard work being a vet, and particularly in those rural and regional communities where you're required to do out-of-hours care. Often there's not an emergency centre close by, so we are required to provide that care to both pets and livestock, requiring care to be looked after or seen in emergency situations. And for those rural regional vets, they can sometimes be working 24/7, especially if they're a solo practitioner. So it is a hard job. It's relentless. We do know that there, in the veterinary profession, there is a higher mental health. There are higher mental health issues, and we do know that that work stress does contribute to it.
You called it out before. One of the proposed solutions was fee relief, but I saw a couple of others mentioned by the report as well, including some changes to funding streams. Are there any other solutions that were proposed or that you guys have considered over the years too?
Yeah, look, we understand that the education fee relief is not going to be a silver bullet. It's not going to solve all of our problems, but certainly for short-term gain, I think it will help. Vets were recognised as essential workers during the COVID-19 pandemic, and doctors, nurses and teachers are all afforded this educational fee relief for going into rural and regional communities. So we see the educational fee relief as really an easy thing for the government to tack us onto. It's not expensive. There's a system already in place. We don't understand what the barriers are for this.
That was Australian Veterinary Association President Dr. Diana Barker speaking with Timu King. Now, Australian farmers and the food industry are being warned to learn from the bird flu outbreak in the US, which has now spread to its dairy herd. The cattle-to-cattle transmission is under investigation, and there's now a push to rename the virus affecting the dairy cows to bovine virus. Honorary professor with the Australian National University, Robin Alders, says she's not surprised about the quick spread through the cattle herd and warned Australia needs to be ready.
I suspect this is not unexpected given the connectivity of dairy herds in the US and the
stickiness of the influenza virus. So animals can be carrying it. It's also very easily transported as fomites, meaning the virus will attach to inanimate objects or to human people in our shoes and move around. So that's the thing that we know about the influenza virus, irrespective of the type, very sticky. And we've had a recommendation from the chapter of bovine veterinarians in the US that the current outbreak be designated as bovine influenza in terms of formal global recognition. That's a decision that would have to be made by the OFLU network, which is a group of animal influenza specialists at the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations and the World Organization for Animal Health, and they are yet to make their position on that recommendation known.
So to a certain extent, do you think it's partly because they don't want to panic people that this flu is not as bad in cattle as it is in birds?
There may well be that element. I suspect that would be coming more from the industry side. What we know is in countries where there have been outbreaks of avian influenza in chickens, it does cause a huge impact on the marketing of poultry products. So it may be that. I do believe that in terms of the bovine practitioners, their interest is in helping their members understand about the new clinical picture, and that they think that a change in name may actually help them with better recognition, that it will jump into their head much more quickly.
At last count, or the last time I looked, 17 states have restricted cattle importation from states where the virus is known to have infected the dairy cows. What's the likelihood of more serious quarantine restrictions being introduced?
I think that's going to depend on impacts on productivity and the potential where you may also have states with very high density of poultry production units.
And I believe we might have an audio issue with that story, which sounds absolutely fine in the studio, but apparently not fine on your radio. So now we'll go to a song, If You Leave, Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark.
Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, and that album is Pretty in Pink. Now, a couple of rural news in brief items. A fire ant infestation in Queensland's Murray-Darling Basin continues to grow, which experts say could allow the pest to hitch a ride down the river system into southern states. The ants were found on an army base at Oakley this week near a tributary of the Condamine River in Queensland, with at least 110 nests confirmed by authorities, with the entire base not yet fully searched. Invasive Species Council spokesman Jack Goff says the sheer number of nests shows that fire ants have probably been at the base for some time, possibly years, without being detected.
This is the first time that fire ant nests have been found west of the Great Divide in the Murray-Darling Basin. And obviously we know with fire ants, one of their ways that they can move is through floodwaters where they form these rafts. So we've been long warning about fire ants getting into the Murray-Darling Basin system as a big red light flashing. And then yesterday we found out that we're talking about 110 nests that they've found. So this is really serious outbreak. The number and density of those nests at this army base in Oakey suggests that the fire ants have been there a number of years, which suggests that there has been a massive failure of surveillance by defence. And this is something that's really concerning, something that the former Inspector General of Biosecurity, Helen Scott-Orr, raises a particular concern in her 2021 report, which was a review report for the government, was defence, what they were doing on their lands in southeast Queensland, and the high risk that they posed to the program, the eradication program, in terms of if fire ants were getting away on that federal land.
And to Western Australia, 5,000 hatchery-reared baby scallops have just been successfully released in the ocean off Perth's coast near Rottnest Island for the first time. The scallops were reared at a Perth nursery as part of a $2.7 million project aimed to increase wild scallop stocks in the state and future-proof the industry against marine heatwaves. Director of the company involved in the project, Clayton Nelson, it says they've been trying to do this since 2018.
There's no doubt this is a really high-risk project, and most projects that have never been successful before are high-risk. I'm confident in the fact that we've got the right people on the job. We've really got to get it done, or else, you know, we potentially risk not having a little fishery that sits out there that supplies this beautiful product to the WA consumer.
Now, when you make your morning coffee or tea, what milk do you reach for? Full cream, skim, soy, oat, almond? What about camel milk? It's a lesser-known milk alternative, but farmers have noticed a growing demand for the product in Australia. In New South Wales, there's just one certified camel dairy and it's located just outside Muswellbrook in the Hunter Valley. Our reporter, Keely Johnson, paid the farm a visit.
It's not where you would usually find camels, but just outside Muswellbrook in the New South Wales Hunter Valley, 50 of them roam the vast green paddocks of Michelle Phillips' farm. She runs the only certified camel dairy in the state, a journey that started a decade ago.
10 years ago, there was only one commercial dairy in Australia, and that was in Western Australia. And to get fresh milk from Western Australia was a plane ticket, and I just couldn't afford that. While I was doing our research, I found that there was a lot of aerial culling that was happening, which was really, really devastating because a camel has a hump and they store food in their hump. So if a camel is shot in the leg, you know, if it's not a kill shot, they can go down and survive for days and have a really slow, painful death. So I was really annoyed about how there was such this majestic, beautiful creature being destroyed and literally left to rot in the desert. And I thought, well, you know, I mean, I can't rescue all of them, but it's going to be a start.
Camels were introduced to Australia in the 1840s to assist with exploring inland Australia. But now the feral population has grown to roughly 1 million camels. And as Michelle explained, they are subject to mass cullings. The animals have long been seen as a headache for farmers and outback communities, destroying fences and infrastructure, causing overgrazing and erosion, and fouling waterways. But Michelle is part of a growing group of advocates wanting more Australians to make use of the animals. So, to start her farm, she bought a group of feral camels off an Aboriginal man with experience mustering the wild creatures.
We started with 5 mothers and 6 babies. We drove to South Australia to pick them up from Peterborough. Just from there, it was just a roller coaster of emotions and learning how to, you know, how do you milk a camel? It wasn't like I could go to the next door neighbour and say, hey, how do I milk a camel? So there was so many mountains to climb to get where we are today.
Once you obviously figured out how to milk them and start getting that whole process, how have you gone about, I suppose, building the business and actually, you know, do you sell the milk to locals or do you distribute it?
We, when I first started, it was basically for personal use. So I just started posting on Facebook, as we all do, oh, look, you know, we're milking camels, la, la, la. One day I drove out the driveway and there was 6 Sahara Land Cruisers parked out the front and all these sheiks, and they sort of said, you know, we've seen you on Facebook, we want your milk. And yeah, it sort of started from there. So majority of our milk goes to Sydney. It's huge out west, sort of Auburn, Lakemba, Bankstown, that area there. So yeah, we have a huge following of the Muslim community.
Camel milk is one of the most popular milks in Middle Eastern and Northern African countries. In Australia, demand for camel milk is growing. However, with just 7 certified dairies, supply is fairly limited. And a camel produces about 4 to 5 litres every milking, which is significantly less milk than a dairy cow. It means the product is quite expensive, between $20 and $25 per litre. So, would you give it a try? Taste-wise, Michelle says it's quite similar to cow's milk.
It is thin on the palate, like a skim milk, but that's because it's really low in fat. But other than that, some people can taste a salty note, some people can taste the sweet. I mean, we've all got different palates, so everybody has, you know, their own little take on how it tastes. But most people, if I walked up to them with a glass of cow's milk and a glass of camel's milk, they wouldn't know the difference.
While the taste is similar, its nutritional profile differs.
Got a good source of protein, it's lower in saturated fat, it's full of vitamins and minerals that are beneficial. So as a replacement, if you're looking for a replacement to cow's milk, it's a great alternative.
That's Susan McLeod. She's a registered nutritionist and senior lecturer at La Trobe University.
And that was our reporter, Keely Johnson, with that report. So it sounds like camel milk is a good alternative, especially if you want something really nutritious, and it might even be good for some of those people that have certain allergies. But test that out before you try, for sure. Thank you for joining the Country Hour today. I'll catch you again tomorrow at noon. Have a good evening.
Get the easy-to-understand breakdown on everything from the lab to the universe. I'm Lucy Braden. Join me and science guru Dr. Carl this afternoon on Drive on the ABC Listen app from ABC Radio Hobart.